I think it's necessary periodically that we come back and re-examine the basic truths on which Christianity is built. I raise again questions that most of us answered a long time ago, but reconfirm ourselves in those answers and re-prepare ourselves to share them with other people. So for several Sunday mornings, I'm going to look with you at some of the basic teachings of Christianity, starting with the existence of God Himself. It seems a strange thing to a lot of modern minds that the Bible nowhere argues the existence of God. Rather than attempting to prove that existence by some detailed argumentation, the Bible simply opens, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." When one reads the Bible, he's quickly impressed with the fact that the choice is not between God and no God. It is between gods. So God says through Moses, "You shall have no other gods before me." Or through Elijah, "How long do you halt between two opinions? If Baal be God, serve him. If Jehovah be God, serve him." Or through Jesus, "You cannot serve God and mammon." The implication in all of these is that we are going to serve something. It's only a question of whether we serve the true God or a God of our own liking or invention. Somehow, in modern times, we become impressed with our own ability to create. We think that everything that has order or beauty is something that we have brought into existence with our own technology. We forget that the very brains and hands that create things of beauty and order were themselves creations of another. It seems to me that there are three or four books in modern times that are responsible for a move of man away from what one can assume in the Bible. Namely, that one will be choosing between gods, but he will be serving something he recognizes as God. But we moved into an age we call secular, which implies that we're not necessarily convinced there's a creator beyond. If I were listing just three or four books and writers who've contributed to that change of mind, I would list a Polish astronomer, two Englishmen, and a Jew who lived out much of his life in America. I'd start with Copernicus, a Polish astronomer who published in 1543 his book Concerning the Revolutions of the Heavenly Bodies. A book of astronomy which had the effect of taking the Earth out of the center of the universe, even out of the center of the solar system, and making it a small planet in revolutions of its own around the sun. So that instead of being the center of the creation, it becomes almost a backyard part of the universe. I would list next a book by an Englishman named Sir Isaac Newton called Principles of Mathematics, published in 1686, in which he sets out the view of a very mechanical universe, pushes and pulls operating against one another, no room for miracle, a universe of law and order, and the same thing that makes an apple fall from the tree to the ground makes the heavenly bodies move in their orbits. And although Newton himself was a man of faith and embraced Christianity, he was author of a book that gave birth to a modern view that God is not needed to explain what is. I'd list thirdly another Englishman, Charles Darwin, who was buried in Westminster Abbey, who in 1859 published a book called The Origin of Species and followed it with another called The Descent of Man, the cumulative effect of which was to say that man is on a par with the rest of nature, another animal, the product of the progress of nature rather than the direct creation of God. I'd finally list Albert Einstein, a Jewish scientist whose theory of relativity has said to us that not only is the Earth not the center of the solar system is very unimportant in our whole universe. The universe is so huge it may be infinite. A space-time universe that dethrones the solar system. A universe that, in its infiniteness, has space that is bent so that if we were to be able to fly in a straight line, we would eventually come back to where we started from, if we survive long enough to make the trek through the heavens. The cumulative effect of all this is to take man out of a position of importance, to remove his feeling of creaturehood, and to give him the feeling of aloneness. being in a universe that operates by chance. Now, over against that kind of conclusion, all through the centuries, there have been certain arguments for the existence of God. Those arguments may, in one instance or another, be more satisfactory to your mind than one of them may be than another. But they're all worth hearing and considering. The first one is a cosmological argument. That is, an argument from reasoning about the cosmos, or an argument from cause and effect. As Thomas Aquinas put it together in the 13th century, and he borrowed heavily from Aristotle in the 4th century BC, this argument says that there are things in motion, that is, change, but nothing changes itself, it's always changed by another. That can't be traced back infinitely, there must have been a first mover, God. Or there must be a sufficient cause for any effect, and the only cause who can explain the effect of this universe itself is God. Or we live in a world of dependent beings, that is, beings that are born and they die. But if the whole universe has nothing except dependent beings, there would have been a time when there was no being at all, and consequently today there would be nothing at all, because there would have been nothing that would have had the power to begin the whole chain anyway. It may seem to you that those are very mechanical arguments, and you wonder if somebody a bit sharper couldn't destroy them. And of course they've been attacked. I just finished reading Mortimer Adler's new book, How to Think About God. He's the man who is known best perhaps for editing the Great Books of the Western World series. Or if you have a recent edition of Britannica, he's the man who put together the Synopticon. Widely read and voluminous writing philosopher. Born a Jew, married an Episcopalian, at least twice is considered embracing Christianity, but instead writes a book now, How to Think About God, addressed to the 20th century pagan. Pagan being defined as a person who's neither Jew, Christian, nor Muslim. Adler goes through the arguments for the existence of God and concludes that the only one that he thinks has a hope is the cosmological or cause and effect argument. And he says it's been offered in two ways. One, a principle of sufficient reason. To have a universe, you have to have sufficient reason for it. But he says, not necessarily, the universe may have always been. Two, the argument from existential causality, which means if I keep on existing, somebody must help me exist. I don't exist by myself. I'm dependent on someone beyond myself for existence itself. Every moment of my being. He says, not necessarily. He goes back to the scientific principle called inertia and says when you hit a pool ball and start it across, it doesn't need a tunnel of air pushing it the rest of the way. It keeps going till counterforces stop it. And when I'm begun as a being, I keep going till something stops me. So nothing has to explain my daily existence. And one might think he's going to conclude no argument for the existence of God. That isn't what happens. As he moves near the end of the book, he says, but there is, when I die, I become something else. My atoms simply form something else. But the universe itself is only one of many possible universes. There may not have been more universes before it. There may not be after it. But it's one of many possible universes. And if it's one of many possible universes, it's possible for it not to be. And eventually, the only way he can explain it is in terms of someone who could have brought it into being and who could take it out of being. And he concludes by saying, I believe this proves the existence of God. However, not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, only the God of the philosophers. And then for people who'd like to bridge the chasm and have religious faith too, he says, what kind of God have I proved? God of power, a God of omniscience, but not necessarily a God of love and justice, because there's a lot of evil in the world. To cross that bridge, he suggests maybe a leap of faith, because the heart has its reasons the mind knows not of. But the impressive thing to me is that a 20th century pagan philosopher writes in 1980 the old cosmological argument that's been around for millennia and believes he's given it a new twist, but believes it still proves. Well, the argument from cause to effect was suggested, at least, in the text this morning. I've said that the Bible does not argue the existence of God, but in Romans 1, verse 20, Paul does say, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. The evidence of God and his creation. Secondly, there's the design argument. We're impressed by beauty and truth and goodness. And as Aquinas argued it, these came from one who is perfect truth and perfect beauty and perfect goodness. Or he put it another way, we live in a multifarious universe. That is a universe made up of many different kinds of things, rocks and streams and animals. And they don't know they're cooperating with each other, but a balance emerges so that we have a stable universe. That argues a designer. The ancients were impressed by it. Posidonius, a philosopher, made a little scale model of the sun and moon and earth and five planets. And his conclusion was, just as it took a mind to make my scale model, it took a mind to make the real thing. Cicero, 1st century AD philosopher, suggested that you might as well think the annals of Aeneas, his writings, were formed by taking the 26 letters of the alphabet and putting them in a pail and shaking them up and letting them fall out by random, as to think this universe was formed by chance. Xenophon, in his Memorabilia, recounts how Socrates used to say the human body is an evidence of design, very weak eye, but lids that serve like doors to allow seeing and sleeping, and a brow that keeps the sweat from falling into it, and lashes that filter the winds, an ear big enough to catch all the sounds but never stopped up by them, incisors that cut the food, molars that grind it. Too much evidence in the human body, Socrates thought, of design for anyone to doubt that there is a God, a designer. William Paley in Modern Times put it in the form of a watchmaker argument. I stumble in a field upon an object, pick it up, and it's a ticking watch. I take it apart and see all those jewels and wheels and springs, and do I conclude must have been an explosion in a small parts factory near here somewhere? Or do I conclude that there is a watchmaker who is responsible for this watch? Paley's argument for design. Well, I read last Sunday morning Psalm 19, which is to me the most impressive statement in the Bible of the design argument, not in argument form, but reflecting on the same truth. But here is Psalm 8. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You've set your glory above the heavens. From the lips of children and infants, you've ordained praise because of your enemies, to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the works of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him? And the son of man, that you care for him, you made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You made him ruler over all the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herds, all the beasts of the field, birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and all that swims in the paths of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. He's reflecting on the design of God's fingers. Immanuel Kant was an 18th century German philosopher who thought both these arguments I mentioned had been set aside, the cause and effect, the design argument. Maybe there is cause and effect all around us in this world, but who knows, the universe is an effect of a cause. Maybe it's different. David Hume had suggested that perhaps it was laid by an egg from another planet somewhere, this earth, in his skeptical way of doubting everything he could. And Kant said, maybe that isn't proved. But there's one thing Kant was sure of, and that's the moral principle in man. Reflecting back on Epictetus, a 1st century AD moral philosopher who said, men are never born with a knowledge of music or of geometry, but every person that comes into the world has an awareness of morality, a sense of oughtness that he can't bargain with. I may want to acquire and possess things, but I'll set it all aside to save someone I love, or to die for a principle I believe in. There's a moral oughtness in me that I can't bargain with. I can't compromise. It's part of me. And Kant said, even though the content of that is different depending on the culture and the way you've been taught, one man may believe one thing is right, another man believes it's wrong, but everybody has to bargain with his sense of oughtness. C.S. Lewis has popularized that in Modern Times by saying every time two people argue, they imply there's a standard of truth. Otherwise, there's no point in arguing. Both could be wrong, both could be right. But they argue because they know somewhere there's a sense of right and wrong, a standard of right and wrong. In Romans 2, verses 14 through 16, Paul says, speaking of the Gentiles who do not have the law, they do by nature the things required in the law, and they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law, since they showed that the requirements of the law are written in their hearts, their conscience is also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them. This will take place on the day when God will judge men's secrets through Jesus Christ, as my gospel declares. Paul speaks of our conscience. The Greek word literally means to know with, co-knowledge. I know with God. I know with the act I perform whether this is right, whether this is wrong. The conscience, of course, may be misled, but I have the standard inside me that cries out to be followed. And Paul says, one day, man will be tried according to my gospel, and even the Gentiles who didn't have the law will be held responsible for walking by the law of their hearts. Finally, there's the ontological argument, the argument from being. It's awfully hard to make clear in brief time. But a medieval monk named Anselm set it out by saying, I have an idea in my mind of a being than which no greater being can be imagined, a most perfect being. But if this being does not exist in reality, any being that exists in reality would be greater than this being which exists only in my mind. Therefore, this being exists. That leaves a lot of people cold. They say, well, you proved an idea in your mind, but if you proved anything in reality, René Descartes, the founder of modern philosophy, added to it the notion that I'm finite and imperfect, but I have an idea in my mind of a being who is infinite and perfect. I'm not capable of originating that idea. God must have placed it there. It's the notion that man has an innate awareness in his being of his creaturehood and of perfection of being, and that perfection demands existence. So God is. If I had to go to a text, I'd go to Exodus 3:14. I am that I am. A text that simply says God's very nature is being, is existence. But now, with all of those arguments, what kind of God would we conclude? We decide he's a God of power. He certainly has a far-flung universe. Light travels at 186,000 miles a second. But the light from the nearest star to us, Alpha Centauri, has required 4 years and 3 months to reach us. The light from the North Star has required 466 years to get here at 186,000 miles per second. The light you see tonight left there in 1515 AD, a few years after Columbus discovered America, traveling at that speed. You'd decide he has to be a God of power. That's what Adler decides in his book. You'd even decide he's a God of order. Must be a mathematician, one astronomer concluded. That's because, to illustrate with one case, back in 1781, the planet Uranus was discovered. Uranus has an orbit of 164 years around the sun. And scientists decided that's because another force is acting upon it that is not yet in view and we don't know about. But calculating from that force, they trained their telescopes on the very date, September 22nd, 1846, to the very place, and there Neptune was. It's an orderly universe. But what the Bible does is to say the God of the philosophers, the God of whom they had glimmerings, has come into the world in human flesh in the person of his Son, and he's no longer unknown. He's made himself known to us. I want to read two texts of Scripture with you. One is in John 1. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. That light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. Here is the Word, the Logos, who was with God eternally, who was deity himself, who is responsible for the light we have in the world, who is a God of love because he's given us the life we have in the world. But the light and the life were too pure, and men turned away from it and preferred darkness, a reflection on the fall. But God didn't abandon us. Instead, he sent witnesses. There came a man who was sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light. He not only sent witnesses, eventually he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. The light himself came. The Logos came. The Word became flesh and lived for a while among us. We've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. The God of the philosophers has stepped out into the open and revealed himself in the person of Jesus Christ. The other text is in Acts 17, beginning with verse 22. Paul is at Mars Hill in Athens. Men of Athens, I see that in every way you're very religious. For as I walked around and observed your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. Now what you worship as something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by the man's hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. Now Paul's made his first point, and that point is God made everyone who exists. And since we were made by him, we have this awareness of being creatures. We were made for his family. So we grope. We try to find him. His second point. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out to him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we're his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. He's made his second point. The God who made us all to be part of his family doesn't dwell in idols or in temples. Those idols and those temples cannot contain him. They can't even mediate him. But his third point. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all men everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man whom he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. God overlooked the ignorance of man because he saw behind man searching and groping a sincere longing. And so he stepped out into the open and revealed himself in Jesus Christ, through whom one day he will judge the world. So that when you and I deal with the pagan, we may not need to be so concerned about his searching and his groping and the many ways he's wrong as we are to appreciate his longing and try to reveal to him the God who has satisfied that longing by coming to us in Jesus Christ. With all that said, the Bible doesn't give much promise to people simply for believing that God exists. You believe God exists? Good, James says. The devils also believe and shudder. What the Bible praises and rewards is the person who believes in God. The person whose relationship with God is formed through faith in him, a trust in his word that leads us to live his life, to do his will. Would you, while we sing, to invite you? Just remain standing.